Thanks for inviting us. I want to say, start off by talking about how you frame the issue of fracking, what fracking is. Because the way in which fracking is understood and described is very important to understanding why we think there are lots of problems with it. And then I want to go on to talk about some of the problems, some of the evidence, the academic research about it, and then I want to end up by talking about regulation, because government and the fracking industry and INEOS will say to you that there won't be any problems, essentially because in Britain it will be well regulated. So I want to address that. But first of all, then, this issue of how you frame the issues. Now, there are basically two different ways of framing the issues. One, as described by the proponents, the advocates of fracking in the industry, and one by ourselves. Now, the trouble with the word fracking is that it immediately conjures up the idea that the problem is something to do with fracturing rock deep underground. Now, I'll not say to you that there might not be a problem with fracturing rock a mile or 2 miles underground, particularly in this country, because in this country the geology is rather different from the United States and say Australia, because there's a lot more faulting. So fracturing under those circumstances is rather different. But the issues are not really about the first impression you might get. Fracturing rock, and therefore the fractures, the cracks lead from the wells up into aquifers and into pollution and so on. That's not really what the issue is. Well, you look at all the literature against fracking, the sorts of things that we're associated with, and what we're opposed to is what we call unconventional gas field development. It's not just what's happening deep underground, it's what's also happening on the surface, and it's all the activities associated with the development of a gas field. So I'm going to talk to you not just about this business of fracturing rock underground, I'm going to talk about all the issues associated with developing a gas field. And particularly, really important to grasp here is the scale and the intensity of an unconventional gas field compared, for example, to a conventional gas field. Now let me do it by, Nigel's already showed you an example of how INEOS talks about perhaps within 6 miles by 6 miles, 10 kilometres by 10 kilometres, there could be maybe 400, maybe 100 wells. Now that, coming off say 30 well pads or whatever, now that's a lot. That is a lot underground. And the reason is essentially that in a conventional oil or gas well, the geological strata underground is permeable. So the oil and gas can flow and could be drained from a single point over a large area. But that's not the case with shale. Shale is not a permeable geological strata. The gas or the oil is trapped in it, and therefore you have to make it permeable by shattering it with this process of fracturing. But you have to shatter it not just at one point, you have to shatter it across the entire layer. Hence the need to do lots of different wells and lots of activity. Now it's this fact that here you've got one well, and here you in this particular example you've got four well pads, three horizontals from each, and then two laterals coming off each horizontal. It's the fact that you've got lots of wells, and you have to have lots of wells, and associated with those wells you have to have lots of activity, lots of water, lots of chemicals, and lots of activity at the surface as well. You have to have at each well pad, not just the access roads, which don't come out very well on these diagrams, but you have to have pipelines, and you have to have pipeline corridors, and you have to have lots of traffic servicing this process, setting this process up, bringing water to it, taking water away, all these sorts of things. There's a huge amount of activity, and it's that scale of operation that is what creates the problem. That's why fracking is a problematic, not just because of this breaking up rock underground. So what you end up with in this circumstances, and I'll go in a little bit more detail into some of the kinds of problems you get in a minute, but what you get is an industrialised landscape, and you get an industrialised landscape which is not easily compatible with other land uses. So it's not easily compatible with agricultural uses because, for example, the pipelines cross across farmers' land. The access roads do as well. You can't imagine having a nature reserve in this area or a leisure facility in this area. You completely change the land use. That land use dominates and drives other land uses away. And it's not easily compatible with residential uses either, which is why when the government asked a group in DEFRA to report on what the impact would be, they produced a report and the government tried to suppress it, but a Freedom of Information Act got the information out that DEFRA admitted that if you were living next to or near to 1 mile from one of these well pads, then it's likely that the value of your house would go down by 7% was what they estimated. And the reason for that is quite simple. It's not very nice to live in a gas field like this. And so who would want to buy your house in those circumstances? So the value of houses go down, and therefore it becomes very difficult for people to get out. Come to lots of other issues soon. I've only just started.
Yeah.
So I would just say, you know, the subsidence. So there's the issue of insurance premiums and those kinds of things as well. Now, when the gas industry talks about this, when companies like INEOS talk about this, they typically frame their explanation in terms of single things. So if you in the INEOS documents, for example, they'll talk about, it said that it industrialises an area, but this is not true. And then they give a long spiel in one of their documents about how each well pad is actually not very big. But that's not the issue. It's not what each well pad is. If it were just only one well pad in 6 miles by 6 miles, wouldn't be the same. It's the fact there's lots and lots of these things, and they're all, it's a gas field we're talking about. That's the real issue. And the gas industry advocates typically frame things in this misleading way. For example, you'll often hear mentioned a report which was published in 2012 by the Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineering, which said that, that actually fracking is going to be safe, can be done safely, if it's designed, constructed and abandoned according to best practice. A single well, it says. It's low for a single well if it is designed according to best practice. Well, of course, you know these two words, these words here, single well and best practice, they're very significant words because, of course, you would never get a single well. It would be quite economically impossible to make it work with a single well. The minimum you're going to have for a gas field to work is going to be, well, at least 100, maybe it's going to work much better in somewhere like Nottinghamshire or Derbyshire with 1,000 wells. So, and that's different, you see, because if it comes to the risk assessment and if it comes to regulation, if you're talking about one well, which is a rate of failure, that's to say it's going to leak, of 5%, risk of failure, which is what the figures are in Pennsylvania in the United States, say, then one well you might decide you were prepared to take the risk. But it's quite different to take the risk for one well and to take the risk for 100 wells, where you're almost certainly going to get about 5 wells leaking, or 1,000 wells where you're going to get 50 wells leaking. These are totally different issues. So if you neglect the issue of scale, you've completely missed the point, and that's exactly why they frame the issues in this way when they talk about these kind of issues. And you also note this thing, best practice. Government is always talking about, and the industry always talk about best practice in the way in which they present the issues. But this is ridiculous. We're not interested in best practice. We're talking about ordinary practice. What happens usually in the real world, and in the real world, you and I know that Murphy's Law applies. If a thing can go wrong, it very often will go wrong. So here's an example of some of the things. One of the things you'll hear from the water industry about water contamination. They'll often say that there are no proven incidences of water contamination that have occurred due to hydraulic fracturing. Again, it's in the definition. Because it's this business about, actually there are now, but there aren't that many in this very narrow definition of this process underground. But what it does is it excludes the incidences from the drilling the borehole and a fracturing of the well. It excludes failed well casings. It excludes tanker accidents and spills and all the rest of it. And when you actually look what the evidence is of those things in Australia and in the United States, it's exactly what you find. You find a very considerable number of water contamination incidents from this thing, because it's happening at a large scale, because there are lots and lots of heavy goods vehicles, water tankers, for example, on narrow local roads and so on and so forth. So this is really important to get hold of this. And also, because there's all this activity going on, there is also a major problem of atmospheric contamination. If you think about that, the whole process of the developing a gas field, it's not just the wells. When they frack a well, they pump water at very high pressure into the well to fracture the rock, laced with chemicals, but also with sand. And the idea of the sand there is that the sand holds the rock, the cracks in the rock open, because the weight will push them back down again. But if they push sand in, it'll hold the cracks in the rock open. But so the actual process of developing a gas field somewhere involves a lot of silica sand mining, for example, and it also involves a lot of use of silica. So silicosis in some places in the United States is actually increasing. And to take into account the full development of a gas field, you have to take into account the leaks from the pipelines, the compressor stations to even out the pressure within the pipeline network. This is a compressor station. Wouldn't you like to have one of those? I mean, in Daniel Street.
How big is it? I have to be interested.
How big is it?
Yes. Probably personally that. Right.
These things also leak. There's a process of cleaning the gas, because when it comes out of the ground, it's not exactly in the form that you want to sell it to a customer in. So you've got to clean it. And as everybody here knows, when you clean something, you gather the dirt together. So, you know, the dirt doesn't go away. You have to pull it together. And what you do, in effect, usually, is you burn it off, which is then, so you get flares, flare stacks, storage depots, there's venting. You probably know how do you keep a pressure cooker at even temperature? You allow it to vent with a certain amount of pressure. Well, that's exactly what you do in a gas field as well. In order to get the pressure at the certain level, you have to allow the gas pipeline network to vent, otherwise the pressure would not be even, and so on. And then the water, 30, 40, 50% of which comes up again from the well, may be used again, but eventually you've got to dispose of it somewhere. So that is also a problem. And the disposal wells in the United States have led to earthquakes. So it's all part of the development of a gas field. Evidence. One of the slides Nigel showed was of Jim Ratcliffe, with his big baggy eyes, and saying that the evidence against fracking is hearsay. Well, it's not hearsay. Since 2009, there have been there have been 700 now, where it went into 2016, there have been 700 academic peer-reviewed articles about the health and environmental effects of fracking. Now, not all of those articles will have new data in them. Some will be commentaries on other articles. Some of them will be about methodology, how to research, and so on. But if you take these articles, 80% of them have been written since the beginning of 2013. That's significant because the government case, which is often reported, for example, in the literature of INEOS, by frackers, is all based on this period here. At that period, the people who were writing about fracking and telling you it was safe was mainly geologists, industry people. Increasingly, however, environmental scientists and medical people have been writing articles and researching fracking. And so this period is a period of massive amount of really good scientific data about it. And what does it show? Well, the articles, peer-reviewed academic articles, was 46 2009 to 2015 about air quality. And of those, 40 studies contain findings that indicated elevated air pollution emissions and atmospheric concentrations. That's for health purposes. That's the significant. 6 studies found that they indicated no significant air pollutants, emissions, and so on. So if you see advocates of fracking, people like INEOS saying, well, there's all these studies which show there are no problems at all. Yeah, there are. In this period of time, there were 6 of them. But there were also 40 studies showing that there were problems. So don't allow yourself to be fooled by that one. In the question of water quality, again, there were studies which showed that there weren't any problems. Problems indicating minimal potential, no association, rare incidents of water contamination. But 40 studies showed potential positive association or actual evidence of water contamination. So these are good quality academic articles by medical scientists, environmental scientists, and so on, showing problems. And the result of that is that on health too, there were 31 studies, of which 26 showed findings that indicated public health hazards, elevated risk, or adverse health outcomes. Now, some of these are, the thing about a health outcome is if you are breathing contaminated air, atmospheric pollution and so on, you won't necessarily immediately fall down dead. If you drink water which is contaminated, it may take a little while to get ill. Things don't happen immediately. You can't say immediately. It's taken a while to get the resources and get this research activity off the ground. This is a relatively new industry. So you wouldn't expect all the evidence to be there immediately, but there's enough evidence now beginning to come through to suggest that the health problems are real. People are getting ill. And that's why 9 professors of medicine and 9 other senior medical personnel in the British Medical Journal said the arguments against fracking on public health and ecological grounds are overwhelming. They're clear grounds for adopting the precautionary principle and prohibiting fracking, as they have done, for example, in New York State at the recommendation of their chief public health officials there, as they have done in France, as they have done to a degree in Germany, and there's a moratorium in Scotland and so on. These are real issues, and people are, the advice of senior medical personnel are taking it seriously.
May I say something?
Sorry?
May I say something? May I say something? Right. This is why they were so, benefits. Because benefits, everybody got benefits in it because of this. They're breathing in ill health. If they stop benefits now, when it happens, fracking, everybody will be ill because of the reason. I mean, I know through chemtrails. When chemtrails are deep, I'm really bad breathing when I'm breathing bad.
We'll come back to those things.
It's all a big ball. Let's get the big picture. You're picking out bits and bobs. Well, I like the bits and bobs.
I agree it's a big picture. We'll talk about it later. Yeah. Okay, the government, I mentioned earlier the government had said that it is safe if it's well regulated, it's a low risk to public health. Their official advisors, an organisation called Public Health England, produced a report in 2014 based on research. Their closing date on the research was the end of 2012, which said that shale gas emissions are a low risk to public health. An overweight, cleverly framed thing. Emissions, not shale gas extraction is a low risk, but low gas emissions. And that excluded water sustainability, noise, traffic, vehicle emissions, odour, visual impact, occupational exposure, wider public health issues. The way in which these things are framed are quite important. And again, the British Medical Journal did an editorial on this Public Health England report, in which they said that it incorrectly assumes that many of the reported problems experienced in the United States are the result of a poor regulatory regime, which wouldn't occur in the UK because we've got this world-class regulatory thing. But that ignores the fact that many of the inherent problems of the industry are such that no amount of regulation will solve the problem that problems like well casing, cement failures, accidental spillage of wastewater and so on. And there's no reason to believe these problems will be any different in the UK. And the report provides little evidence to the contrary. So let me move quickly on to regulation. The government acknowledges that there would be, this is in their a report called the Strategic Environment Assessment, which was written for the Department of Energy and Climate Change in 2013 by a consultancy called AMEC, and they acknowledged that there would be problems with wastewater disposal, health of communities, workers, land use, geology, soils, landscape, visual amenity, diversity, habitats, ecosystems, noise, vibration, air quality, traffic, flood risks. All of those would be problems, except every time in this report they use the same words over and over again, it can be assumed, it can be expected that planning controls or that regulation will mitigate so the problem will be not unacceptable. They didn't explain how, and they didn't explain what proof they had of this, but they just, whoever wrote this AMEC report earned some easy money. They just said what the problems were, and then they said each time, but the regulations will do away with these problems. Here's an example of the assumptions of the regulations. Now, anybody see any problems with that? The problems with that we already can see, because we've now, a few years, two or three years down the line, have got experience from the exploratory wells in Lancashire and in North Yorkshire. In Lancashire, Quadrilla, every single well they've had some technical difficulty with. They've had well bits trapped in the ground, they've had to abandon wells, they've had earthquakes, they've had the earthquakes nearly breaking, fracturing the well casing. They've had 10 breaches of planning conditions, five examples of drilling problems, three reprimands and so on. So loads of problems. And in Yorkshire, between July and mid-October 2014, there were 14 breaches of environmental agency permit conditions. And the important thing about these is that it was local people who had to fight like hell to get the Environment Agency out and the planning people out to do something about these and take notice of it. Because the regulatory system in this country doesn't work very well. It doesn't work very well for reasons which, first of all, it's based on crazy assumptions. One of the crazy assumptions it's based on is that, well, I said the problem with fracking is not the development of fracking of an individual well, it's all the issues, cumulative issues of developing a gas field. But what you cannot discuss in the British regulatory system or in the British planning system is whether you are going to have a gas field or not. Discussing and agreeing the issues at that level is not allowed. The way in which the system is set up is to salami slice the issues. You can only ever discuss whether you can have planning permission for this exploratory well, or an environmental permit for this exploratory well, or for this process, and so on. So each of the issues is taken separately, like that. What you can't do is discuss the development of a whole field. So they have set the process up in such a way that you cannot actually, so this man says, John Ashton was a former climate diplomat for the UK, and he's put it quite well. Each step in the journey can be discussed, but the destination is off limits. But they know that the government and the industry know that if they had each time to get a separate planning application through, and each time a separate permit through, and have a consultation each time, it would take an eternity. So they're gradually working towards a situation where they are streamlining and simplifying the regulatory process. That's the what it's described. And the office in central government with responsibility for that is the Office of Unconventional Gas and Oil, which was in DEC, but NEC, as Nigel had said, has now been reorganised into the Department of Industry. So off, Office of Unconventional Gas and Oil, off you go. Remember it like that. Off you go is stuffed full of people who were seconded from the gas industry. Does that surprise you? Okay, so what they're working on is speeding up the permitting process, so there'll be no time to look at unique circumstances for meaningful consultation, and there'll be a standardisation of the permitting process. And the whole process, once the permits are issued, is based on self-monitoring. You let the companies monitor themselves. They mark their own homework. That's why I said earlier on, industry, the local communities have to fight to get issues and problems dealt with. So let me turn finally to the issue of climate change. Is it a couple of weeks ago, the Committee on Climate Change, which has a status created by the Climate Change Act of a few years ago, is the official body to advise the government on what its policies should be on climate change. They said that if the shale gas industry was to take off adequately, at scale, to be economic, then there would be a problem, and that problem would be that it would be impossible for Britain to meet its climate commitments under the speed at which it will be necessary for Britain to reduce its emissions of greenhouse gases. And so they said that the Committee on Climate Change report, which came out, said there would have to be three conditions met to allow for the possibility of the development of the shale gas industry. The first one would be that any development, extra production of shale gas in the UK would have to be matched by a reduction in imports of gas. The second thing would have to happen is there would have to be a real effort and a lot of inspection to ensure that the leakage of methane in the shale sector did not occur at a massive scale. A problem had been in the United States that a shale gas industry has a problem with what are called fugitive emissions. Fugitive emissions mean leaking gas wells, leaking gas installations, and what's leaking is methane, and methane is a far more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So this is quite a serious problem for the industry, and it undermines their argument that using shale gas rather than coal is good for the climate. So they would have to deal with that. And the third condition that would have to be met that somewhere else in the economy, if they were going to allow the shale gas industry to expand, the emissions would have to decline even more rapidly than this. not been specified where that is, but that's what would have to happen. The mechanisms for this do not currently exist. The mechanisms to get these three conditions in place do not currently exist. And the government has said, well, we'll deal with that problem if we come to it. Because it may not, it may never happen. I'll finish with this remark, it may never happen, because in 2011 in Poland, there was exactly the same situation as in the UK at the moment. Everybody thought there was going to be a big shale gas industry going to take off, was going to be a major influence on Polish economy. And what happened? They drilled 75 exploratory wells. They fracked 25 of those exploratory wells, and none of them yielded enough gas to be commercially viable. At most, they got a third of the gas that would have been commercially viable out of some of the wells. So the whole industry completely flopped, and for all we know, that may happen in this country as well, especially as the gas price is so low. It's a sort of indication of the desperation, if you like, of this industry, that they're still going for it under these circumstances. But they are, and since they are, we're still campaigning against it. So thank you very much.